It's an honor to have Rav David Stav with us this morning. I don't know how many of you saw the article a few weeks ago in the Canadian Jewish News that basically said that there would be no better candidate for the chief rabbinate of Israel. And I don't want to embarrass him, but really, Rav Stav is a wonderful person, a modest person, a Talmud Chacham, a leader, a thinker. He's one of the founders of Tzohar, which is, I guess, for lack of a better term, sort of the modern Orthodox rabbinic group in Israel, trying to impact, not trying, they are succeeding, but there's a lot of work left to do to interact with the entire Israeli population, the religious, the secular, and he was one of the founders of Yeshivat Hesder in Petah Tikva, and he serves as the Rav of the community of Shoham, and it's a pleasure to have him here and an honor for us, Harav Stav.
Thank you very much. Good morning to everybody. Boker Tov. Let me make a very short announcement. Number one, I am not a financial expert or a financial analyst. In order to interpret all the process that the Israeli economy and society are going through, I'm not an expert for national security as well. But what I am an expert for is to try to analyze the impact of the last two issues. How does it impact the future of the Israeli society as far as Yiddishkeit is concerned and as far as the Jewish identity of the Jewish state is concerned? You know that the Israeli tradition, the Jewish tradition, have never met throughout Jewish history the concept of Avrech. Well, we read in Parashat Miketz that Paro appointed Yosef to be his deputy and then he's called Avrech. But in Hebrew we use the word Avrech today to describe a person that decided to dedicate his life to learn Torah instead of going to work. You know, in the Ketubah, each one of us that are married has written in his Ketubah that he's committed to bring food for his wife. Chiyuv Mezonot, it's called in the Torah. The Torah describes this as She'erak suta ve'onata lo'igra. And there is a very famous article that was written recently in one of the Haredi booklets that deals with a question that a couple came over to the rabbinical court and the woman sued her husband for not giving her mezonot because he kept on learning in Koilel and couldn't bring money home. And the question was whether the rule of the Gemara that if someone says to his wife that he cannot bring her food, whether, and the Gemara says that this is a reason to force the husband to give a get, whether this halakha applies today. And the Rabbanim were not ashamed to say no, it doesn't apply today without being concerned that they will be accused to be reform or conservative rabbis or modern rabbis. And they said the following: each woman knows that when she's getting married to a Kohenik, she knows already it's like a umdena, it's like a condition that was done before the wedding that she's supposed to support her husband and not vice versa. So that's not a reason to sue the husband for a get and for not being committed to the fulfillment that the Torah commands him to give mezonot to his wife. Things have been changed in the Jewish people throughout the last century. And there was written a book in Hebrew, I don't know if you had the chance to read that book. It has about 800 to 900 pages on the Chazon Ish. And this book, written by Dr. Brown, sponsored by a few American people that wanted this book to be printed very much, but nevertheless, it has not been translated yet to English, so I guess many of you did not have the chance to read that book. But he describes beautifully how the Chazon Ish, one person, changed climate of entire society and changed actually the approach to the attitude of learning and going to work. Where in the entire Jewish history, we never heard of such a phenomena that an entire society, I mean, we always knew that there are people that dedicated their life and devoted themselves to learning, and that's very nice. But usually it took place among the rabbis, the Rosh Yeshivot, very few people, a small minority of people, and maybe the people that were lucky to be the son-in-laws of very wealthy people that could allow themselves to hold their son-in-law and to learn for 5 or 10 or 20 years. But these were very seldom. I mean, these were the very small minority. But the vast majority of the people did not hear about a koile, did not hear about something that requires people to go and to dedicate their life to learn and not to work. By the way, today, it's not only that people go to learn and do not go to work, but the people, I'm talking about the Haredi society, the people that go to work because they do not like to learn, or they have no ability to hold themselves and to finance themselves with the kollel. The people that do go to the kollel, and the people that do not go to the kollel and go to work, they are not allowed to send their kids to the same cheder. There is one school for Haredi kids that their parents go to work, and there is a second school for Haredi people that do not go to work. Because chas v'chalila, they could get mixed, and the children of the Avrechim that are considered to be pure oil, shemen zayit zach, chas v'chalila, they may be involved or may be mixed with the people that go to work. Because not because they are not Haredim, they did not become modern Orthodox, in chas v'chalila, God forbid. They just decided that they had no choice but to go to work. And that's enough for them not to have the ability to send their kids to the same school. So why do I care about something that occurs in another society? Well, the truth is that I should not care. That's the way people prefer. They make their preferences and they have their priorities, and it's okay. I don't, although it's against the Rambam that condemns whoever who is getting his panosa from learning, and especially a whole society that is getting its panosa from learning. But forget the Rambam. There are people that disagreed with the Rambam. Okay, they could rely on the others. That's not the point that I'm trying to point out now. When we deal with 5,000 people, 10,000 people, 20,000 people, it's their own business. When we deal with a society that is now almost 8 to 10% of the society, and these people demand national support, government budgets to support them, this becomes already something. I'm not talking from the economic point of view, which is the job of others to speak about. I'm referring to that from the social Jewish point of view. What does it do to the Israeli society? The fact that the secular or the modern Orthodox person feels that when he goes to work and he has to pay taxes, he has to support the people that forced him to give them charity because they decided to be poor, as what we call poverty merzon, from their own will. It's not poverty that they have been forced to get to, but a poverty that people chose to for themselves, and the others, the rest of the society, has to support them. This causes, number one, to hatred. And the hatred is something that it's impossible to describe. You know, from time to time, you hear the story of of that poor soldier or girl that one Haredi boy spitted at her or hit her or something or cursed her. That's the symptom. I mean, that's the edge. But the average people like to hate others. And they fell in love in hating the rest of the religious people, the Haredi society, that has become a symbol for people that do not go to work, do not go to army, and we have to support them. Combine these two issues together and you get the direct recipe for hatred, sinat chinam, or maybe not chinam, but sinah for sure, hatred between societies, and this could not survive for a long time. People will not agree to live in a state where they feel that they are, and I will use the Hebrew expression because I don't know to translate that expression to English. That's one reason. And second reason, because it sounds so terrible in Hebrew, I prefer to leave it in the original word. Israelis don't like to be frayerim. Did you ever heard this word? Frayer, that's a motive of life by the Israelis. This explains why many times they could not stand in the line for too long. And they will skip somebody else's. But that's the main motive for an Israeli. He doesn't like to be a frayer. And what does it mean to be a frayer? Frayer means to be someone that feels that another one took advantage of him and utilizes his goodwill. And we, as an Israelis, we don't want to be in that position. Not when it comes to our feelings to our relationship with non-Jewish people, not when it comes to our relationship with our neighbors next door to us. We don't want to be friars. And since we don't want to be friaring, this is the number one reason why people will not be able to survive in a state where they feel that someone is taking advantage of them. That they have to work for somebody else. That's number one. Let me give you another number. I'm not sure that you are aware of that number. We started in the 1st of September, a few weeks ago, we started the new year of learning. Shnat HaLimudim has begun. And all the papers were full with the following number. 50% of the kids of Kita Aleph, 50%, were about 25% Arabs, 25% Haredim. The rest of them were or national religious kids or regular secular kids. Well, I don't know if you understand what's the meaning of that number. So we can build, and from time to time there are secular that build on a trend that maybe many of the Haredim will be Chozer B'Sheela, as they try to create a kind of illusion. Well, that's not going to happen. They are not going to become Chozer B'Sheela. Well, there are few that will become, as there are more that will become Chozer B'Tshuva, most likely. So, you cannot build on that. This means that if you look in the eyes of the average Israeli, he says to himself, what's going on here? I'm going to be here in this state in 10 years, in 12 years, because in 12 years, the kids that started Kita Aleph, the first grade, these are going to be the year, in 12 years, they are going to go to the army. They have to go to the army. But I know that they will not go to the army. I know that they will not go to the university. So I will be a part of the minority, and the numbers are growing. Next year it's supposed to be to 51%, 52%. So I'm supposed to be the part of that group that will be 40%, 45% of the society, and I will have to carry on my shoulders these people. Well, I'm not going to do that. So I have a very easy choice to take. I will go to the university, I will go to the army, and afterwards I will fly right away to the Silicon Valley, to other, to elsewhere, and I will not be there because I don't see my future here. That's the result. These are the consequences of the numbers that I've just mentioned. This leads to the second problem that our social situation has been created recently. If I was concentrating now, so far, I was focusing on the crisis between religious, Haredi religious society and the rest of the society, this is one problem that we have to face with. But there is a second side to that problem, and that's the problem of the Russian immigration. The Russian immigration, which became, according to few analysts, became also a kind of a social nuclear threat of the existence of the State of Israel. Not because they are bad people, they are wonderful people. They met. I mean, we don't want to generalize, but usually the immigration from the previous Soviet Union has contributed to the State of Israel a lot. And we don't even have the words to appreciate what that miracle has done to the State of Israel in every measure that we will measure. But unfortunately, among these people arrived to the State of Israel since 1990, more than 400,000 people that by definition are not Jewish and they have to convert. And the others, not because of halachic reasons, but because of procedure reasons, are considered to be non-Jewish until their identity will be testified or be proved. And so far, they are considered to be, or their Jewish identity is suspected. Which means that in Israel, we have today about 1 million Haredim, or close to 1 million Haredim, if I combine two Haredi parties, and we have 1.3 people that their Jewish identity is suspected. Well, these people, when they want to get married, they cannot do that in the State of Israel, because according to the law of marriage and divorce, they have to get married in a halachic way. But the halacha will not allow them to get married until they will prove that they are Jewish. So when these people that go to the army and sacrifice their lives and they go to the universities and they will meet original Israeli Sabres girls or boys and they would like to build their homes together and they would like to build their families, they find it almost impossible to do that. Because the rabbinate will not allow them to do that because they have no way to prove that they are Jewish. So this is another social nuclear threat, because when you have a society that wants to get married and does not have the ability to do that in Israel, and they will do that in Cyprus or elsewhere, the kids will not be considered as Jews, because if the fathers did not have the way to prove that they are Jewish, the kids, for sure, kal vachomer, will find it very difficult to prove. Most of them will not be motivated to do that because they will find enough people to get married with. We're talking about a population that is about 2 million. If that 1.3 million is getting married to another 1 million, they will create their own nation. And you have another recipe for tearing up the society, the Jewish society in Israel, to at least two pieces. There will be one Jewish traditional nation, Jewish nation. There will be the one suspected Jewish nation. There will be the Haredim, and we didn't count yet the Arabs. An army could not go to war under these circumstances. And we hope that we won't have to come to that situation. But we have to prepare ourselves. And this is a recipe for destruction. I'm quoting the former head of the Mossad, Ephraim Halevi, that said it in several opportunities, that this is the real threat on the existence of the state of Israel. Not the Iranian threat, but this is the real threat on our existence. If I take these two issues, the division between the Haredi society and the rest of the society as far as taking responsibility and sharing solidarity and being a partners in going to the army and in going to the university and in going to work to help to bring Parnassah for themselves. If that's one issue. And the second issue is the question of the ability of the Jewish state to remain one Jewish nation because of that division of the people that their identity is suspected and the other ones that their identity is not suspected. These two issues will not be, unfortunately, will not be in the coming up elections. They will not be on the top, they will be secondary. Thank God, the first topic will not be war and peace, because everybody understands that there is nothing, there is no one to do peace with, so therefore there is almost no difference between the parties, not the right, not the left, and almost people try even to hide their political views regarding the future of the Judea and Samaria, etc., etc., because everybody understands that this is not something that bothers the Israeli society anymore, at least for these coming up elections. Everybody understands that the Iranian threat will be dealt this way, another way, by the same prime minister, if it will be by Netanyahu or Yakimovich or somebody else. Everybody understands that there is no difference between them. The main issue that is going to play place in the coming up elections is the economy, the social justice issue. We all remember the riots, the demonstrations that took place a year and a half ago. And I guess this will play the first issue that will be in the national agenda. But the second issue will be the issue that I've just raised now. The split, the division between the societies, referring religion and state, referring Haredi army and economy. What do we have to offer under these circumstances? Well, number one, I'm not a politician. I'm not intending to be. And therefore, I don't know how to deal with the crisis that takes place and splits between the Haredi world and the entire society. I don't know how to deal with this. I know only one thing. That we, people that encourage what we call the way of Torah v'Avodah, should strengthen ourselves. We should be more confidential in our way. We should make sure that our kids will understand that being fully committed to Torah does not contradict the commitment to go to work, does not contradict the idea of going to university, does not contradict going to the army. I'm proud to be a father of sons. That I have one son that is, two sons went to the army, one is now an officer in the army, and Baruch Hashem is continuing to be observant and raises his kids to be observant. And I have another son that went to the army and now sits and learns in Alon Shvut, in Rav Lichtenstein's yeshiva, Ezer yeshiva, and wants to become a Talmid Chacham that will combine Torah and Mada, Torah v'Avodah. It's not something that we can take for granted, because in our society there are voices as well that maintain that and that suffer from inferiority complex, because they see that maybe it's easier to take the decisions of black and white in the Haredi society and the complexities that we have to face with and the problems that we have to deal with are much more complicated. So we see, I see personally, and I'm invited to speak in many places about these issues, that in our youngsters, these questions are raised, and we have to make sure that people understand that our way is not a compromise, that our way is inclusive, that our way understands complexity of life, and that we understand the Torah was given to us in order to be implemented in ways that it will fit to a modern society and to a modern state to be established and to be run. And our way is the only recipe for implementing Torah in modern life. But to tell you that I have a direct answer how to deal with a political crisis that will come sooner or later between the Haredi society and the Haredi parties and the rest of the Israeli society, I have no solution. What bothers me and what concerns me is the fact that many secular people think that this is what is religion, what's religion about, and this is what the Jewish heritage has to offer, and that's our struggle. And here I come to the second issue. We established our organization 15, 17 years ago, right after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, and the idea that we wanted to bring to our society was the following: we shall bring Judaism in a way that people will understand that to be Jewish does not mean to belong to an ancient society that does not will to confront and to face with the modern challenges. When we established Tzohar, we understood that the coercion that exists in the state of Israel causes so much hatred and so much ignorance toward to the Jewish people that we cannot continue with that anymore. I told already that story yesterday, and I must share this story again. I know that there might be some people that heard that story, but for me, this story symbolizes our way. I live in Shoham. Shoham is a beautiful city. I guess everybody that lands in Israel sees that that's the first city that you see very close to the airport. Shoham is a new city. It was built 15 years ago, 16 years ago. I'm there from 1998, a few years after it was built. And now it has about 21,000 people that live there. Most of them are secular. When I say secular, I mean secular. Not traditional, but secular. Voters of Meretz, Labor, something in that area. The Likud there has a very, very few votes. And I built my house surrounded by non-observant people. And I've done it purposely. I wanted to live in a non observant neighborhood, and Baruch Hashem, I have the privilege to do that, to be there. And once my wife asked me, maybe we'll offer our guests, our neighbors, to come over to our house to see how Bdikat Chametz looks like. And I said to her, why not? And we suggested them to come to see how it looks like. As it happened, from time to time, we distributed the 10 pieces of bread, and one piece was not found. By the way, it hasn't been found until now. The kids started to scream to each other, where did you put that piece of bread? And everybody is arguing and fighting, and everybody accusing the other one, where did you put that piece of bread? And then the neighbors, it's a family with three kids, they're looking at us, and the man asks me, Rav David, I know you usually as a very relaxed person. What happened? How come you're so mad? You're so nervous? So I said to him, look, we are missing one piece of bread. You know, it's a problem. So he said, what's the problem? I have plenty of bread in my house. I can bring you as much bread as you need. Could you imagine a family lives next door to the rabbi and has no idea about what Chametz is about and what Pesach is about? They live next door to the rabbi and they have no idea whatsoever about what is Pesach. And they live in Israel. They went to the army. They went to Jewish schools, to elementary schools. You know, once the principal of the high school calls me and asked me, "Please, Rav David, I want you to come to the high school." What happened? Our girls, with the delegation that went to Poland in the last journey, they met several groups from Australia, from South Africa, from other places. And they met them where they were making ceremonies near Treblinka or near Auschwitz. And they had an Holocaust survivor that said Kaddish. And my kids, my students, asked their teacher, "What are they saying?" And the teachers didn't know what to answer. And I was there, and I was shocked. And I said to myself, the first telephone I'm making after I come back from Poland is to the rabbi. And I ask him, "Please, I want you to come to this delegation every time before they fly to Poland, 2 or 3 weeks before that, and to explain what is Kaddish about." And I said to her, "Look, it's very nice, and I'm coming, and I do it every year." But then once I dared, you know, our vision in Tzohar is not to push ourselves. Well, we are asked to come, we come. We don't push ourselves. We're not pushing. And once I dared to ask her, "You know what? Kaddish is very important, but you know, there are a few other things also that might be suitable to them. Think about the idea, maybe I should escort this group when they fly to Poland to explain them a bit more about how Poland looked like before the Holocaust." She almost was shocked. A rabbi with a secular group, I have to think it over. Okay. I'm not pushy. Second year, she calls me and she said, "You know what? I asked the teachers. Originally, we were afraid what will the parents, the anti-religious parents will say. And then we started to ask and we got hints that it will be okay. So please, we urge you to come to escort our group to Poland." I think I was the first official rabbi in the state of Israel that escorted a secular group to Poland. And the reaction of the group afterwards was the teachers, the principals, and the students. And that's the most important. We have never been exposed to what has been offered to us now. And the question is, what caused that ignorance? What caused the fact that these boys have no idea about Kaddish? Have no idea about Chametz, have no idea about Shema Yisrael? And there is a very, very simple reason. Coercion and hatred. When people feel that they are coerced, they don't want to listen to you anymore. When people feel that you take advantage of them, they don't want to listen to you. When people feel that you hate them, they don't want to listen to you. And that, this was our, not that we wanted to broadcast that, to deliver that message, but this was the way our message was accepted. Because of the law of divorce and marriage, because of our behavior to the couples when they arrived to the local rabbinates, because of other reasons, because of the fact that this 1.3 million, when they come to the local rabbinates, then they are told that they have to prove their Jewish identity. Nobody tells them, "How could you prove that you are Jewish? Okay, I'm fine with that. But help me to prove. Is it my interest to prove that I'm Jewish? Or is it your rabbinic interest as well?" And that's the challenge. Will we be open-minded to understand that if these 1.3 million people will not be recognized and will not be assisted to prove that they are Jewish, if they will not be Jewish, maybe our kids will meet their kids and our kids will also not be Jewish. Maybe that's what we are doing now, putting ourselves in danger. You know, people think that the challenge of assimilation, to face assimilation and to fight with, applies to the diaspora. It's true. But it's true that the same problem applies to Israeli society as well, especially because of what I've described in the last couple of minutes. Our challenge is to understand that it's our goal to help these people to prove that they are Jewish. For instance, by us in Zohar, we opened a department named Shorashim, Roots, which its goal is to help the Russian immigration to prove that they are Jewish. Recently, we understood that it doesn't apply only to the Russian immigrants. It applies to the Canadian, to the American, that made Aliyah, Baruch Hashem, to the South American people from Argentina, Venezuela, and other places, that made Aliyah and found themselves in the end of the day that their Jewish identity is questioned, and that they find it very difficult to prove that they are Jewish. We find ourselves last year dealing with more than 200 cases from North America, helping them to prove that they are Jewish. I can tell you stories from now. I don't know how much time I have, Rav Kam. Half an hour, but I have to leave time for questions. Okay, so I will just finish with a short story that happened to us 2 years ago. A girl came to us from Germany. She made Aliyah from one of the very nice cities in Germany. She brought a letter from the rabbi that she's Jewish. By the way, she happened to be Orthodox as well. She came to my office with a long shirt and with a skirt, and she with a long sleeves. Kitzur, she's observing Shabbos. There's a problem. The rabbi that wrote the letter, as it was explained to me, why it was not accepted. Because the rabbi went off the derech. That was the answer that I got. And I asked, what do you mean when you say he went off the derech? What derech was he and what derech did he leave? What do you mean he became reformed? No, he's not reformed, he's Orthodox, but you know, we cannot trust him. Okay. She learned in a Jewish school, she brought a letter from the Jewish school. She came over to my office and asked her, she tells me her mother and her grandmother are Holocaust survivors from Bergen-Belsen. And I ask her, do you have evidence that you are right? She says, sure. They took a picture when the camp was released, and they show the pictures in Yad Vashem. The Yad Vashem puts it in their expositions. Exhibitions, they put it there, so you can see it there. Could you bring me a copy of that picture? Yes, no problem. I could go now to Yad Vashem and to bring the picture. So I said to her, please, hold on a minute. And I called the head of the chamber of the chief rabbi and asked him the following. Look, if she will bring the picture from Yad Vashem, proving that her mother and grandmother were in Bergen-Belsen, will this satisfy? And he said, yes. It will be okay. It will be enough. So I said to him, look, she has a letter from the rabbi, and you don't accept it. He's off the derech. She has a letter from the Jewish school, and you don't accept it. But you want the picture from Yad Vashem. Okay, she will bring the picture. But let me tell you something. It's 2 days now before the Memorial Day of the Holocaust. 2 days before Yom HaZikaron, La Shoah Vela Gvua. And let me make it very clear to you. She will bring the pictures. But once she will bring the pictures, I will make sure that Yediot Achronot and Yisrael Hayom will put this story in the first page. The way you behaved to that granddaughter. And he said, okay, I understood. We will let her go through and she doesn't have to bring the pictures from Yad Vashem. Now, the problem is not that someone there is a bad person. No, not at all. All people there are very good people. The problem is that people do not understand what is the dramatic problem that we have to face with. People don't understand. People think that they are officers that go to work from 8 till 4 and they have to do to drink a cup of tea or to do something else and they have to give service to customers that like you give in the national security or in the DMV in the States. But they don't understand that we deal here with souls and we deal here with the future of the Jewish people. And if that girl will not come to us and she will fly to Cyprus, her daughter, her son will not be considered to be Jewish. And this will lay on our responsibility, on our shoulders. Our challenge is to understand that to go and to chase after each Jew that is ready to be helped. Many of them do not want to be helped because they are so embarrassed for us because we suspect their Jewish identity. They suffered in Russia, they suffered in Argentina, and now they feel that they suffer by us as well. Many do not want to go through this process. But even though they want to go through this process, make it accessible. Make this process something that will be friendly to them. Make them feel that it's your interest to prove that they are Jewish and it's not their interest to prove that they are Jewish. Because it's our responsibility to save each one of them. If we know it's written in Shulchan Aruch, is it a mitzvah to be mechalel Shabbos in order to save somebody's life, physical life? And the Shulchan Aruch brings in Ilchot Shabbat, the same rule applies to the idea of being mechalel Shabbos to save someone's spiritual identity. If someone's daughter was taken to a church or to another place, the Shulchan Aruch says that it's a mitzvah to be mechalel Shabbos in order to save her. Because there is no difference between the idea of pikuach nefesh when it comes to the physical life or when it comes to the spiritual life. And here you have hundreds of thousands of Jewish people that want to be Jewish. They came and made aliyah in order to be Jewish. And now you push them away. The last story that I want to share with you is a story from last Wednesday. I left Israel Wednesday night. And that story took place few weeks before Wednesday, but it ended up by me officiating the wedding of that couple Wednesday night. And when I'm talking about these stories, we have thousands of stories like this and so on. We can open books, we can open write a whole shelf of books that will be full of these kind of stories. That person made aliyah from Los Angeles. He was born to a conservative family in Los Angeles. And when he made Aliyah 10 years ago, it brought a letter from the conservative rabbi that he's Jewish. There is no conversion in the family, no problem. But as he knew already in advance, no one was ready to accept that letter. So therefore, he went to the council of the synagogues of the Orthodox rabbis in California and asked their approval for his Jewish identity, to approve the letter that he got from the conservative rabbi. And they met their test, and they checked, and they gave him another letter from their council of rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, that approves that this boy is Jewish. He made aliyah, according to the law of return, and now, Baruch Hashem, he fell in love with a girl from my city, from Shoham. And then, he went to Tzohar to be registered, and then he has to bring approval that he's Jewish, and there is a problem. The Jewish agency that had the letter from the council of the synagogues lost the letter. So they wrote a letter to the council. They lost the letter as well. They have no idea what happened with the letter, with that letter, and they have only the letter of the conservative rabbi, which is not, has no meaning in the local rabbinates in the state of Israel. So what will be the next step? There is no way to deal with that. I mean, what can we do? You have to prove that you are Jewish. So I talked to his mother. She lives yet in Los Angeles. And I tell her, look, we have a few rabbis in Los Angeles that are very friendly with Zohar. Please go to them and ask them to check again your mother's identity in order to make sure that she's Jewish. And the mother I met the mother on Wednesday night, and she describes with tears how she had to go with a rabbi, that happened to be a very nice rabbi, and she went with the rabbi to the Orthodox cemetery in Los Angeles, where her mother and her grandmother were buried there. And he took a picture of that cemetery and of that grave. And she came over to me, thanking me for helping her son to remain Jewish. I sent him and I encouraged him to make Aliyah, to go to the state of Israel, to be Jewish. And if the people of Tzohar would have not helped him, he would find himself in the end of the day coming to Israel to be Jewish, and then having the need to get married in Cyprus, and then having your Jewish identity suspected for the next generations, which is something that we cannot understand. And therefore, this is the challenge, and we have the power to face this. We would prefer to do it from the top, to understand that it's possible to change the system and to make the chief rabbinate more welcoming, more hugging the couples that come to her, understanding that she has to take responsibility for Klal Yisrael. Bezrat Hashem, we will succeed, but even if we will not, we in Tzohar, we will continue to be the power that will help these couples to prove their Jewish identity. And Baruch Hashem, we helped throughout the years thousands of couples to do that, and we'll continue to do that. But we prefer to do it in a way that will be including the entire society, and not only the people that get to know us by advertising or from friends. We want to make it the official system of the State of Israel that is welcoming all these people that want to be Jewish and are Jewish and have to prove that they are Jewish. I would like to add one more thing before I give time for questions, and this is the challenge of conversion. I want to add two numbers. We have 400,000 people that made Aliyah that are not Jewish. They are not Jewish halachically, but most of them are Jewish emotionally. Most of them have Jewish fathers. Most of them have chosen to come to the land of Israel because of the feeling, the deep feelings to the State of Israel. They could leave to the States or elsewhere from a long time ago, and they prefer to stay by us. Let me tell you, I was once a rabbinical judge with Rav Drukman in Or Etzion, Merkaz Shapira, and we had a case of a very famous Rav that his brother-in-law came from Russia. And the brother-in-law was a goy, but he was married to the sister of that Rosh Yeshiva, a very famous Rosh Yeshiva. Mipnei HaKavod, I don't want to mention his name. One of the biggest Rosh Yeshivas of the Haredi world. And then Rav Drukman gets a phone call from one of the Knesset members, the Haredi Knesset members, that always attacks Rav Drukman for his conversions, and says to him, "Please, I ask you to convert the brother-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva." And Rav Drukman says, "No problem, but he has to go to Ulpan Giyur, and he has to go through our exams. It's not something that you can do it just because he's the brother-in-law of the Rosh Yeshiva." But he said to him, "But he's the brother of the Rosh Yeshiva. Do you want the Rosh Yeshiva's sister to be married to non-Jewish man?" I remember Rav Drukman crying, saying, "And what do we deal the whole day with? Don't we deal with the Eineklach, with the grandchildren of Rav Mohaliver, Rav Kalisher, and Rav Soloveitchik? All of these names we met in our meetings, in our sessions in the rabbinical courts. Who are them, the immigrants from Russia? They all belong to the families of the most famous Rashi Yeshivas in the Litvish and or in the Polish or in the Russian world before the war. We deal with these people that are the brothers or the nephews or the nieces of these people, of these families. We can't differentiate between them. The end of the day, they went to Beis Din, not to our Beis Din. They went to a Haredi Beis Din that made the conversion right away, no problem. They know to attack us when we have our policies, but when it comes to places where they feel that they need to make the conversion, they have no problems, no logic problems, no other problems. When it comes to policy, to politics, to attack Rav Drukman or others, when they deal with the real work of being Mekarev, these people that, it's true, they're not Jewish halachically, but they want to become Jewish. It's true, many of them will not be totally observant. But the question whether they will be observant or not is mainly depending on us. How friendly will we be towards them? Will we adopt them in our communities or not? Do we see the conversion as a strategic aim for the chief rabbinate, or do we see this as a threat for the existence of the Jewish people or not? Do you know that every year there are born in Israel 4,000 kids that are not Jewish from these immigrants, and the conversion is dealing with less than 2,000 people a year, which means that now in our days we have more than 95,000 kids between the ages of 0 and 18. And if we talk about the numbers of 18 to 30, we can assume that it's double, that are not Jewish. Not that we have to prove their Jewish identity. And if we won't take care of this problem, now many, thousands of these kids learn in religious schools, learn in Orthodox schools. But they are not converted because their mother is not willing to convert. And the chief rabbinate doesn't want to agree to convert them. Not because Rav Amar doesn't think it's true. He believes that's the right way to do. But they are afraid. They are afraid of the politicians, of the Haredi politicians that pressure them not to do that. Rav Rabinovich, that used to be here, the rabbi in Clanton Park, I think, pressures me already a few months since a year ago. Rav Stav, what are we doing with these kids? Why don't we convert them? Please, I will support every effort that you, your friends in Tsar and in the chief rabbinate or elsewhere will do in order to solve that problem, because it's crucial for our future. And we are talking about these boys that are getting married in Israel, and this is a real assimilation if they don't convert. These are the challenges, and we hope that Bezrat Hashem will be able to be successful. Rav Kamen, you wanted to leave me a few minutes for questions?
I want to thank you for such an uplifting talk. That was a great
move. Really, it's, we do have time for questions. We'll raise the microphone. I think what we should do is, not for many, we'll take three or four, like right in a row. If you want to come to the microphone, first come, first serve. There's no running or pushing. Come to the microphone, ask your question. That's a question, 30 seconds maximum, and then Rav Stav will answer them all in one shot. I think that's the best way. I hope there's some questions. I mean, there's a lot of food for thought, but...
And if you ask at the microphone, and then we'll take all the questions. Yeah. Dr. Gruber.
The issues you're raising are of great concern to many Jews here as well as in Israel. The solution, it seems to me, lies in changing the chief rabbinate. You have a chief rabbinate that gives hechshers on restaurants and other things, and the people who give the hechshers won't eat in those restaurants. It's a corrupt system. It's a corrupt system. What are you doing? An election is coming up. What are you doing to ally yourself with secular Jews and others who have the same view of the rabbinate as you have to ensure that there is a change in the chief rabbinate?
The truth is that your question is a wonderful question, and I spend most of the time, besides being in Tsar and in Shoam as a rabbi, and besides trying to learn a bit, is with the secular leaders. I could tell you that I've met just recently with Yvette Lieberman and Shelly Yechimovich a week ago. And these are the topics that we deal with. Next week I'm going to meet with Yair Lapid about these issues. Our concern and our programs are to gather together all Zionist parties, religious and non-religious, under the idea that the chief rabbinate should be a kind of an institute that will take care and will take responsibility for Klal Yisrael and not for certain groups. I agree, we wrote a whole agenda about the kashrut problem, and I agree with you 100%. I mean, it's a shame that most rabbis, the vast majority of the rabbis, the official rabbis in Israel, give hechsher, but will not eat their own hechsher, but not only that they will not eat their own hechsher, that's mele. They could say we want to be mehadr, but it's not only that they won't eat their hechsher, but when they will come to a place that do use that hechsher, they will demand to machshir the kelim, which means that it's not only a hidur, but they consider their own hechsher as treif. That's the meaning. There is no other meaning to that. And it's a shame that we arrived to such a situation. The reason for that is when the rabbis that serve in the rabbinate do not see themselves as representative of Klal, but see themselves as representative only of a very small crowd, that's the result. Ken, bevakasha, please.
What is happening with the Ethiopians in Israel now? How are they fitting into the current society?
I think we have to divide the Ethiopian issue to two parts. There is the halachic part and there is the social part. The halachic part was dealt very nicely, relatively nicely. There are one, two rabbis that are authorized to register the Ethiopians, and they have to go through a short process of conversion, and usually they do it and there is no problem with that. The main problem with the Ethiopian immigration is not halachic, but it's a social problem. Usually, the rabbinate demands that they will go to religious schools. Now, once they go to religious schools, and the Haredi schools don't want to accept them, so they have to go to the modern Orthodox schools. Once they go to the modern Orthodox school, and since they're coming in large numbers, so you could imagine that a class that, for instance, a school that had 200 boys and girls, and now they have another 300 boys and girls Ethiopians, this could destroy the school. So this causes a lot of problems, and people actually seek after problems. The idea that people understand that it's time arrived already, that they will be distributed to many schools in order to allow them to be absorbed in the schools in the right way. So far, it has not occurred. And therefore, there are there are a few schools that are 95 or 100% for Ethiopians. It causes a lot of problems. First of all, it looks like racism, but number two, it doesn't help them to develop themselves and to be integrated to the Israeli society. It is a problem, and this problem will escort us for the next couple of years. I don't see any solution in the soon future.
What percentage of Israeli society are they?
No, very few. It's I don't think it goes. We are speaking about 100 to 150,000 people. It's not relatively. It's a very small group. Okay.
Shalom Rav. I agree with everything you said. To just challenge and come from the other side. Where is there hope? Where would you like to bridge a gap with the Haredi community? So how can you try to work together? Where is that hope? And secondly, on the tough issue of conversion, I didn't understand what you were saying in the end as to how do you view what is a halacha conversion? I'll leave it at that.
Okay. I'm not an enemy of the Haredi world, not at all. I think that the Haredi world should get the same approach that the entire society gets. I think that the have to be a part of the society, and they have to get the same approach and the same attitude. By the way, I believe that a change in the system of the rabbinate could serve their interest as well. Because so far, they are accused for all the faults of the rabbinates, and many times it's not their fault. I mean, they don't have to suffer because of some politicians that caused them such a image or caused such a damage for their image. That's number one. I look for ways to bridge the gaps between us and them, but it's mainly based on the dialogue with the people and not with the politicians. Because the politicians of the Haredi world understand that the fact that the Haredi world is segregated and is not integrated to the Israeli society gives them a lot of power. And that's what threatens them. They understand that once they will go to the army, once they will go to the university, maybe they will not need their politicians anymore. Maybe they will not need the budgets from the Knesset members that distribute every year before Pesach or before Sukkot, like the Chalukah system that existed in Israel 100 years ago. They will not need them, and maybe they will not vote for them anymore. That's what threatens them, and therefore I want to differentiate between the political Haredi leaders and the society, the Haredi society that many of them would like to open the gates toward an open-minded society. That's number one. The second question is a bit more complicated. I did not bring here sources to give a share about the policy of conversion. But let me say one thing, which I think for me it's more than enough in order to explain the difference. The main question that differentiates between us is not the question what is the level of mitzvot that they should observe or not. That's not the issue. The issue is the approach to the candidate of conversion before he is converting. Do we want to encourage him to convert? Or do we think that it's still relevant what the Rambam is saying? When someone comes over to you and he wants to convert, number one, push him away. No, we don't want to push him away. It's our interest now to be mekar of him. We want to hug him, we want to encourage him to become a convert. Because we know that what the Rambam was saying in that halakha referred to a goy that came from nowhere and wanted to convert. But the Rambam himself in a tshuva, when he refers to people that were the sons and the grandsons of people that were the Anusim somewhere in Morocco or in Taiman, he did not refer to them in the same way. So what we are trying to do, to say is, number one, the approach has to be changed. The approach to the converts has to be, we want you to convert. And we want to convince you that to be Jewish is something very important, and very nice, and very tempting. We want to make Jewish something that people would be desired to be a part of. And not that will be pushed away from having any kind of desire to be a part of that people. Thank you.